returned to the kitchen and focused on the orders, wishing for the night to pass quickly. She wanted to return to her flat and just curl up on her bed. The kitchen clattered with noise, and each time the door swung open, she could hear the quizmaster's booming questions. Native to Australia, this amphibian mammal lays eggs. Which actress played Marta in The Sound of Music? What did Jesus send his disciples out with? A. Sticks and stones. B. Bread and money. C. Scrip. D. Staves. What's a scrip? Nicky wondered as she pulled open the dishwasher door. A burst of scalding steam rushed to her face. She yelped and shoved the door closed. Sanja rushed to her side. Here, open your eyes, let me see. Nicky blinked a few times to clear her blurry view of Sanja's face. You be careful with that thing, Sanja said, tossing a look of contempt at the dishwasher. The alarm beeps before the dishes are dried. I should have warned you. Gary called out to Sanja. She snapped back at him in rapid Russian.
Thanks, Nicky said. She opened her eyes. And thanks for standing up for me.
You don't know what I said. It sounded like the Russian equivalent of fuck off.
Correct, Sanja said.
Sanja's kindness helped the remaining hours of Nikki's shift pass a little more quickly. The trivia crowd was good-natured tonight, even after Steve with the racist grandfather answered a question about North Korea with, Me love you long time! Yet by the time Nikki's shift was over, her anger at Sam still had not subsided. She marched to Sam's office and rapped on his door. Come in, he called. Nikki entered. The dishwasher's got issues, she said.
Yeah, I know, Sam said, not looking up from a spread of papers on his desk. I'll get it fixed soon.
You need to get it fixed sooner than that, Nikki said. Her voice wavered. Now Sam looked up.
I'll fix it when I've got the money, Nikki. If you haven't noticed, things are tight around here.
It's a hazard, she replied. Besides, if you haven't got the money, why are you hiring new staff? What's the deal with this Joe, Sam?
It was satisfying to see Sam look so taken aback.
Am I supposed to check all my hiring decisions with you? I think I'd have a more professional opinion than you.
Is that right? Sam said wryly.
Do you know what those idiots in the kitchen have been saying about me? That you hired me because I seduced you. Is that right, Sam? Because I sure don't remember it that way. Here I was thinking I got this job because I was a hard worker, but...
Nikki, I'm going to stop you right there.
Sam's tone was infuriatingly calm now, but distinct worry lines scored his forehead.
I haven't hired Joe. She's my niece, my sister's kid. Remember my weekend in Leeds? It was to bring Joe back down here. I'm training her as a favour. She just turned 18 and she has no idea what she wants to do with her life. She and my sister haven't been getting along very well, so I thought I'd step in.
That sounded like something Sam would do.
But that still doesn't excuse... Nikki began.
Sam waved away Nikki's words.
I should have talked to you about the whole asking you out thing. I was too embarrassed. I had no idea those guys were giving you a hard time about it. I'll have a word with them.
You don't have to do that.
Won't it make it easier if I tell them to stop?
I'd rather they hear it from me, Nikki said. If you rush out there to defend me, it'll just confirm what they think.
Fine then, Sam said. As long as you know that I hired you because you're reliable, you're a good worker. I could see that in you right away.
That's the opposite of what my law tutor said. He pretty much said I didn't even bother trying.
You knew what you didn't want to waste your time with. That's a skill in itself.
Honestly, I wish I'd listened to myself more before taking on this pub. It's a crumbling mess at the moment, and I wish I loved it as much as I'm going to have to pay to keep it from falling apart.
Nikki still could not help feeling self-conscious about her outburst. She returned to her bag to get the business card for Turrenpal's contractor.
Sam, if you're interested, these guys are supposed to be quite good, and I'm guessing they're affordable because they've done some renovation work for this lady I know in Southall.
Sam took the card and then whistled.
Oh, you're joking. Affordable? I know this company. I called them for a quote when I wanted to remodel the restrooms. They charge through the roof.
Really?
Nikki asked, taking the card back and examining it. How did Turrenpaul, living on her own without an income, manage?
Hey, Sam, these cutbacks aren't going to affect my job, are they?
Sam shook his head. As far as I'm concerned, you could work here forever.
Nikki smiled with relief.
Sam continued, but that doesn't mean you should.
Try something else, Nikki. With that brain of yours and that way you have with people.
I still don't know what that is.
You'll figure it out, Sam said.
He sighed, looking around.
I'd do things differently if I were in my early 20s. I inherited this pub from my dad because it was something to do. But if I hadn't, I'd have opened a bicycle rental shop and a beachside resort somewhere. I'm tied to this place now. It was charming at first, and for a while I loved stepping into my dad's shoes, but once the novelty wore off, it just became a workplace. I don't think it will be like that with bicycles. But as long as the pub is standing, I've got to stand here with it. He shrugged. Obligations, you know.
Dancing in the rain. He liked to take long showers to wash off the stresses of his long day at work. His wife complained that she never saw him. He was out of the door first thing in the morning, and then in the evenings he was washing off a day's worth of grime and sweat from his construction job. The water bills were very high, and by the time he was finished, all the hot water was finished as well. "I can't do anything about it," he insisted. "This is my only chance to relax." The wife was hurt. "There are other ways to relax that we can both enjoy," she reminded him. The man looked at her in confusion as his wife walked away. He shrugged and went into the bathroom and started taking off his clothes. He could feel the soreness in every muscle and the tightness in his shoulders. A moment later, the bathroom door opened. His wife appeared, wearing just a towel. The man began to understand now, but he still just wanted to be alone. He held up his hands and waved his wife away, chiding her for interrupting his private time. The wife paid no attention to his protests. She raised her arms, letting go of the towel. As it fell onto the floor, the man could not help noticing his wife's body, and he tried to remember when he last saw her, standing in front of him completely naked like this. He turned around to turn on the shower and felt her drawing close to him, her nipples hard against his bare back. The water splashed on their faces as if they were dancing in the rain, but they were actually moving very slowly. Her delicate hands ran smoothly across his body, wiping away the grit and soil from work in the depths of the earth. So removed from small luxuries, like the first drizzle of clean water after a punishing hot day. He shuddered as she moved down to his large shaft and began stroking it. She kissed his face, his lips, his neck. Her strokes increased in speed to match his short, sharp breaths. He pumped his organ into her palm. With the other hand, she scraped her nails lightly against his back. Her fingertips spelled out words of adoration in the sheen of water on his skin. He jerked suddenly into her hand with a throaty moan. "We've never done it like that," he gasped. She smiled and buried her face in his hair. There were many things they had never done together. When it was his turn to return the favor, he was very attentive. She stood with her back pressed against the wall and parted her legs. He flicked his tongue against the tight bud at her center. The water continued to fall on them. Her legs shook with the intensity of pleasure, and she clutched his hair, feeling waves of warmth radiate within her as she came closer and closer to bursting. It was almost painful. Her skin tingled with the sensation of the water on her skin. Every part of her was suddenly aware and sensitive. She cried out loudly. "Don't stop," she called. "Don't stop." He didn't. The class applauded,
Preetham blushed. It was an unusual story for her, Nicky thought. And then she noticed a detail missing. What are the names of the people in your story? They don't have names.
Oh, give them names, Arvinda said pityingly, as if compelling her to give sweets to a child.
John and Mary, Preetham said.
The room broke out into a mix of giggles and protests. Give them Punjabi names or Indian ones at least, Bibi urged.
I just can't see Indians doing this kind of thing, Preetham said.
How exactly do you think babies are made? Arvinda asked.
Not that, Preetham said. This couple isn't making babies. They're just pleasuring each other.
Where did you get the idea for this story from, Preetham? Tanvir asked, squinting slightly at Preetham.
From my imagination, Preetham said.
Tanvir turned to Nicky.
Nicky, what is it called when you present work that isn't originally yours? You can get expelled from university for it. Satpreet Singh's son got caught doing it. There's an English word.
Plagiarism, Nicky said.
Yes, Tanvir said. I remember that word because nobody knew what it meant. Even Satpreet Singh was confused. He didn't think the punishment would be so severe for copying a few paragraphs from a library book. My son was using his wits, he kept saying. But the English are very fussy about the truth. Preetham, you have done plagiarism.
The word was mangled by her accent.
You're mad, Preetham said, but she did look a bit worried. I can't read English books. Where would I get this story from?
Channel 56 at 1 a.m.
Surreptitious glances shot about the room. Nicky didn't have to ask what was on Channel 56 at 1 a.m. because their knowing smiles told her everything.
There was a movie on the other night about a couple. The man came home wearing one of those fluorescent vests. He was a miner or something. And then he said something in English and his wife led him into the bathroom. They did exactly what you described.
It wasn't in English, Arvinda said. It didn't sound like English. It was French or Spanish, I think. The German ones are the best, piped up Bibi. Their men are so sturdy looking.
Your secret's out, Preetham,
Tanvir said with a grin. Preetham squirmed.
There's nothing to watch on the Indian channel late at night, she protested.
Maybe we should move on, Nicky said. I've got the rest of my story now, Tanvir offered.
The one about Rita and Meera? Arvinda asked. Tanvir nodded.
Yes, please. Tell us what happens, Bibi said.
Rita led Meera to her bed. The sheets were lightly tousled from the night before, but Meera refrained from telling off the young girl for not making the bed. She felt a strong and urgent pulsing in her loins as she lay down on the bed and closed her eyes on Rita's instructions. Rita's breath was hot on Meera's skin. They kissed passionately, playfully flicking their tongues. After unbuttoning Meera's top, Rita gave her nipples gentle bites through the fabric of her bra. Meera gritted her teeth. The sensation of this young woman teasing her flesh made her want to scream with ecstasy, but she knew there was even more pleasure to come. Rita stroked the peach between Meera's legs. There was such heat radiating from Meera that Rita knew she was ready. She peeled off Meera's clothes and put her fingers into her wet, swollen center. Meera whimpered with delight. Her whimpers became deep moans in rhythm with Rita's steady movements. Rita's fingers rotated gently in a circle, preparing Meera for what would soon come. The clay stick lay on the bedside table. Meera glanced at it occasionally. Rita shook her head. Not yet, she said firmly. She knew it was cruel to withhold pleasure from this woman who so badly wanted it, but Rita wanted to prolong this experience. She had great power over Meera now. She could get her to do anything she wanted. How Rita managed this moment could determine the course of the rest of her life in this home. Rita pulled away from Meera and took out a bottle of coconut oil from her dresser drawer.
She and her husband had used coconut oil together on their first night, and sometimes, to surprise him, she rubbed it all over her body and then waited in bed for him, naked and glistening. She made a show of it now, stripping for Mira, who watched her every move. Then she tipped the bottle of oil into her hands and rubbed them slowly over her breasts and stomach and thighs. She was aware of how sexy she looked, a goddess with glowing bronze flesh. She returned to bed and reached for the clay stick, which she rolled over her body from her neck to her stomach till it was slick with oil. Mira enjoyed the show. She turned on her side and watched Rita, mesmerized. "Show me what you do with it," Mira said. Rita lay down and spread her legs and slipped the stick into her silken folds. She guided it in and out of herself, bucking and sighing the way she did with her husband. With one hand, she clutched at her naked breast, twisting her hard nipples between her fingers. She met Mira's gaze. "You get it now?" she asked. She drew the stick out and sat up. "It's your turn," she said. "Lie down." Mira shook her head. "You keep going," she said. "Oh, don't tell me you want to stop now." "I don't want to stop." "Then what is it?" Mira cast a shy gaze over Rita's naked body. "All this time I spent envying you. I was actually lusting after you. I want to keep admiring your body." It was Rita's turn to go shy. "I had no idea," she said. "I thought you resented me." Mira pressed her lips to Rita's. They shared a long and passionate kiss, during which Mira reached down and wrapped her hands around the stick. She slipped it into Rita and began to pump it slowly. "What do you want me to do?" Mira asked. Rita's eyes flew open in surprise. She never thought she would be in the position to ask anything of Mira. Yet here the older woman was, ready to serve her. "Go faster," Rita commanded. Mira obeyed. "Faster," Rita said. She groaned and tipped her head back. Mira's feverish movements were making her thighs quiver. She raised them so the stick could be driven in deeper. "Ah, ah," she cried. Beneath her, the sheet was soaked in her sweat and her juices. She pulled Mira's face to hers. "I'm very close," she whispered. Mira pulled out the stick. She lay on top of Rita and rubbed against her. The feeling of Mira's hot flesh against Rita's made her excitement mount quickly. She wrapped her legs around Mira's waist. Each grinding movement made her gasp and moan. Both women clutched each other, trying to prolong these sensations. Their climax arrived quickly. Mira shuddered and dropped her head to Rita's collarbone. Rita stroked her hair. In this short moment, both women were closer than they had ever been, but they were also lost in their own thoughts. Mira was wondering if she would ever be able to go to bed with her husband after experiencing Rita. Rita was thinking about the order of Mira's life that she had just disassembled. "From now on, I will decide where everything belongs," Rita thought.
"My, my," Arvinda said, "a chilling twist." "Very good," Bibi remarked.
"Thank you,"
Tanvir said. "Don't you think it's a good story, Preetam?" Arvinda asked. "It's very original." Preetam, who was feigning a sudden preoccupation with her nails, muttered a quiet, "Yes." After the women were dismissed, Sheena hung back at Nikki's desk. "I have some news about Manjeet." Nikki had noticed that Manjeet was absent for the second class in a row. "Is she all right?"
"She's left Sathol."
"What? Why?" "Her husband had another stroke last week, and that nurse girlfriend of his decided she wasn't cut out to take care of him anymore. She left him. When Manjeet heard that he was sick and alone, she packed up everything
and went up north to take care of him.
She's gone permanently? Nikki asked. Sheena shrugged. This is only what I heard from one of her daughters, who came to the bank the other day to transfer some money over to them. She said Manjeet was talking like everything was back to normal, like he'd never left.
She shook her head. After everything he put her through, and she's staying in that house that he bought with his girlfriend in Blackburn. I don't know whether to consider her a loyal wife or a huge pushover.
Both titles sounded like the same thing to Nikki. She surveyed the empty classroom.
Oh, I wish I'd had a chance to talk her out of it, or at least say goodbye. It's a good thing we've added Tanvir and Bibi to the class. With Dharampal and Manjeet both gone, it'll start to look like we have too few students to continue running the classes.
Yeah, Sheena said. There's something else I need to tell you, she hesitated. You have to promise not to be angry.
Whatever you did, I'm sure it's nothing which can't be fixed.
You won't be angry, Sheena prompted.
I won't be angry. Sheena drew in a breath and released her confession in one rapid stream.
I made copies of the stories to show to a few more friends.
Oh,
are you angry?
Nikki shook her head. I suppose that's to be expected. The stories would probably have got around by word of mouth, so a friend reading them isn't so bad.
The thing is, my friends were really into the stories, especially the one about the tailor. They made some photocopies for their friends, and their friends might like to come to the class as well.
How many friends are we talking about here?
I don't know.
Three?
More.
Five? Ten? Well, we need to make sure that we don't raise any suspicions.
More. Women outside Southall want to come to the class as well.
How did this happen?
Emails. Somebody scanned a story and all of a sudden they were being sent to mailing lists everywhere. One woman who approached me at the temple today lives all the way in Essex.
Nikki stared at Sheena.
You promised not to get angry,
Sheena reminded her.
I'm not angry, Nikki said. I'm shocked.
She looked around the classroom at the empty seats and remembered the anticipation with which she'd arranged the tables on that first day.
I'm sort of impressed, she said. I thought about compiling them into a book, but it never occurred to me to just make copies and send them around like that.
I must admit, I didn't intend for the stories to get around either. I just made that first copy for my friend who dropped in for a visit from Surrey because she was grumbling that she didn't have anything good to read. She called me up right away and said, send more. I scanned a few more, but I made a mistake. I left the originals on the copier at work. Guess who returned it to me?
Rahul?
Sheena blushed.
He pretended he hadn't noticed the words on the page, but they must have caught his attention. At lunch the next day, he said, you seem to have quite a colourful imagination.
Oh, Nikki said, what was your response?
I just smiled mysteriously and said, there's a blurry line between imagination and reality.
Very smooth.
Rahul won't tell anyone,
Sheena said. I'm not worried about him, Nikki said. My concern is that we won't be able to keep these stories a secret from the brothers.
Mine too, Sheena said. But if we hide, we're letting them have all the power, no?
The question was tentative, but a new and noticeable strength edged Sheena's voice. That's right, Nikki said. She opened the cassette player and pulled out the tape rather too enthusiastically, leaving a trail of brown tape caught in the machine.
Here, spool it back,
Sheena said, handing Nikki a pen. Nikki took a closer look at the tape.
Oh, I've ripped it, she said. Bloody hell, tonight's stories are gone.
It's all right, I can remember most of the details. I'll write down what I can and I'll read it aloud to the group next time, Sheena offered.
Thanks, Sheena, Nikki said.
She gathered the unspooled tape and wrapped it neatly around the plastic casing.
Oh, that was my last cassette too. You don't have any spares?
I must have left them in the box I took to Turnbull, Nikki said. She was met with a questioning look from Sheena.
I took some story tapes to Turnbull's house last week because I felt bad about not teaching her English. It was an apology of sorts.
How did Dharampal react? Sheena asked.
She's still keen to learn English, but she refuses to come back to our class. I tried to persuade her, but...
Don't let her come back, Sheena said. It's better without her.
You dislike her that much? I know she's a little more traditional, but I thought you were all friends.
Dharampal isn't anybody's friend, Sheena said.
I don't understand.
The seconds ticked by almost audibly as Sheena studied Nikki, deciding. When she finally spoke, her voice was firm.
Whatever I tell you stays in this room, all right?
I promise.
First, let me ask you something. Did you go inside Dharampal's house?
Yes.
What was it like, your first impression?
It was really nice, Nikki said. Everything looked recently renovated.
Did you ask her how she paid for all those renovations?
No, I thought it would be rude. I was curious about it, though. I got her contractor's card, and when I recommended those services to my boss, he said they were very expensive.
I'll bet they are. You'd only use top-notch contractors if other people were footing the bill, Sheena said.
Who?
The community,
Sheena said, gesturing at the window. The curve of the temple's dome was visible in the window. People milled in the car park, their chatter rising to fill the pause.
Anyone with money is paying Dharampal to keep quiet about their secrets.
Dharampal blackmails people.
She doesn't call it that, Sheena said. She considers it a form of help. It's the same thing her husband used to do.
Has she ever asked you for money? Nikki asked. Would she try to blackmail us over the classes?
Sheena shook her head.
Very unlikely. She only targets the wealthy.
Nikki remembered Arvinda holding out her palms and saying Dharampal wouldn't be interested in them. Now she understood what Arvinda meant. They were empty. There was nothing to take from a widow.
She knows it's not worth it, Nikki mused. How do you know all of this, Sheena?
For my birthday last year, I decided to pamper myself with a manicure from Chandani's. The girl doing my nails told me about it. She said that Dharampal's main victims are also the salon's regular clients, those rich women we saw in the Langar Hall the other night. Dharampal's husband left behind a list of people in the community who had consulted him about their indiscretions. He had records of what people told him and the prayers he prescribed to them. Dharampal uses the list against people. Maintaining an honourable reputation in this community is worth a lot of money to those families, especially those who can afford it. Like the parents of Sandeep Singh, that boy who picked her up in the white car after she stormed out of the class that night. He's gay. His mother had approached Dharampal's husband to get him to adjust his behaviour somehow. Sandeep often drives Dharampal around to pay off his debts.
How much do people have to pay her?
Nikki asked.
Whatever she demands. Of course, she doesn't put it that way. She tells him that she's continuing her husband's work, that she puts in requests for special prayers in India to put them on a righteous path again. She claims that the money goes towards fees to cover long-distance calls and travel expenses for her prayer agents. It's all done with lots of sympathy and smiles, but everyone knows she's running a thriving enterprise on shame and secrets.
Wow, Nikki said. She recalled the hardened look that crossed Dharampal's face when she talked about honour and shame. No wonder she took it so seriously. It was her livelihood. It's hard to imagine Dharampal running any sort of enterprise.
She's very skilled. She truly believes she's making things right, offering some sort of service to restore people's pride. The people who pay her end up believing it too. Otherwise, they wouldn't part with their money.
When discussing Maya's suicide, Dharampal had struck Nikki as rather unsympathetic, her concern largely focused on Juggy's reputation. Nikki had thought Dharampal was simply being overprotective, but now it made more sense.
It's sort of ingenious, Nikki admitted.
Sheena narrowed her eyes and started to say something. Not that I condone it. I won't be inviting her to return to our classes, Nikki added.
Good.
Sheena said. She looked relieved. I don't need her poking around in my business.
That's fair enough. The only one permitted to poke around in your business is Rahul, Nikki said with a grin.
Nikki! I couldn't help it.
There's still nothing going on between Rahul and me.
Still? Nikki asked. Come on.
Sheena dropped her voice and gave an exaggerated flutter of her eyelids.
We met up for dinner last weekend.
Oh, and?
It was very nice. He took me to a restaurant in Richmond. We drank wine in a restaurant that overlooked the Thames. After dinner, we walked along the river. He wrapped his jacket round my shoulders when the breeze became too chilly.
How lovely, Nikki said. Sheena's eyes glistened with the excitement of new love.
Are you going to keep seeing each other?
Maybe, Sheena said. If we can keep meeting up outside Southall for a while, then yeah. I didn't run into a single Punjabi person in Richmond. At first I was afraid of being seen. It's not that far away, and my in-laws have loads of relatives nearby in Twickenham. But I forgot about all of that. You don't notice who's watching you when you're enjoying yourself. You don't care, either.
Would Dharampal try to blackmail Rahul as well if she found out? Nikki asked.
The tension returned to Sheena's face.
He wouldn't have enough to offer her, Sheena said. She's more interested in wealthy people, remember?
Nikki shook her head.
It was I feeling sorry for her, being caught in the middle of that awful tragedy.
Sheena looked at Nikki sharply.
She spoke to you about Maya.
Yes, Nikki began to say, but then she considered what Sheena had revealed about Dharampal. A seed of discomfort lodged itself in her chest. Once again, she felt like a complete outsider. For every question she asked, there were hundreds more that went unanswered.
I only know what she told me, Nikki finally said.
And I'm sure she told you a very good story, Sheena said. She clutched her handbag and made her way towards the door so quickly that Nikki had no chance of asking her to stop. Chapter 10 Kulwinda's bones told her she was back in London. Before the pilot announced the landing, she felt the rheumatism seep wetly into her body. In India, she'd been able to climb flights of stairs and to push her way through the throngs of people. Her sandals had clapped against the soil of her ancestral land, announcing her arrival. Now she was in Heathrow, wearing trainers with an old shalwar kameez and being ushered by a grim-faced attendant into the customs queue. Her last trip to India had been with Maya. They had spent hours in bazaar stalls, feeling the fabric of exquisite saris crinkle beneath their touch. Kulwinda had bought Maya a pair of small gold-hooped earrings.
Oh, Mum,
Maya had said, a smile spreading across her face as she picked them out of the box.
You didn't have to.
But Kulwinda had been overcome by a sense of generosity towards her daughter during that trip, and she kept on buying her things, as if knowing that their remaining days together were numbered. She had been tempted to give her the whole world.
"Passports! Internationals over here! British citizens here!" the attendant called, forcing her back to the present.
The line began to break as people moved into their designated rows. The attendant made her announcement again when Kulwinda was approaching the front of the queue. She held Kulwinda's gaze.
"Can I see your passport, ma'am?" she asked.
She wasn't unkind about it exactly, but expectant, as if she already knew Kulwinda's story. Kulwinda handed over her passport.
British,
she informed the attendant, who returned her passport and walked away, pretending not to hear her. This had happened before. She'd grumbled to Maya about it, who didn't understand.
What do you expect them to think, Mum?
Maya would ask, staring pointedly at Kulwinda's clothes, in a way that made her wonder how it was possible to love your daughter and dislike her so much at the same time. Sarab was waiting on the other side when she got out. He gave her a chaste squeeze of the hand and asked, "How was it?"
"Good," she said. "It was home."
As she said this, her heart filled with sorrow. Maya had occupied more space in her trip than she'd hoped. She had visited temples and lit candles for Maya, and for the truth of Maya's death to emerge. In the middle of a distant relative's wedding ceremony, she had left, clutching her side so people thought she was ill, but it was actually the unbearable pain of watching the bride and groom take their solemn steps around the holy book together. London hadn't changed. The wind whipped her face, spraying her hair with mist. She pulled her shawl over her head and followed her husband to their car. The city's flat outskirts greeted Corwinda with the usual dismal views, walls covered in swirls of graffiti, scaly rooftops, and the wide glowing forecourts of petrol stations.
"Are you hungry?" Sarab asked as they neared Southall. "I had something on the plane."
"We can stop for something if you'd like."
This was his way of saying he hadn't eaten dinner. Corwinda calculated the number of meals she'd left behind for him. There would have been enough for every night she'd been away, including tonight.
"Maybe McDonald's," he said.
Corwinda said nothing, and Sarab pulled in swiftly to the drive-thru. She pictured him sitting there every evening, ordering his regular meal.
Fillet of fish and chicken McNuggets, and chewing slowly to pass the time. The prepared meals would still be in the freezer when she got home, and she would defrost them for dinner in the next few weeks. This happened every time she went away without him. In a strange way, it was comforting. If Sarab couldn't eat home-cooked food without her, it meant he had missed her, a sentiment he would never express in words. It also reminded Corwinda that he would survive without her.
"Let's sit inside," Corwinda said. "I don't like to eat while the car is moving."
He agreed. They parked and entered the restaurant, finding a booth in the corner next to a window. The restaurant was noisy with the sounds of teenagers. It was Friday night. Out of the corner of her eye, Corwinda noticed a few Punjabi girls, but she was too jet-lagged to try to figure out whose daughters they were.
"Your writing classes have certainly been very popular," remarked Sarab. "I was at the temple the other day and saw some women heading into the building."
"Which women?"
Corwinda asked. While in India, her problems with Nikki had become as distant as London itself.
"I don't know who exactly," Sarab said. "I did run into Gurtaj Singh at the Langar Hall the other day. He asked me what was being taught in those classes. I told him Nikki was teaching the women to read and write. He said, that's all."
"Was he suspicious?" Corwinda asked.
She recalled the note Nikki had left on Tarampal's doorstep. It still didn't make sense. Why had Nikki apologized? But if class sizes were increasing, it meant that Corwinda's initiative looked successful to Gurtaj Singh.
"He seemed impressed," Sarab said.
They ate their meals and returned home. The house smelled familiar and foreign at the same time. Corwinda breathed it in and felt a hard hit in her gut. "Our daughter is dead." She turned to Sarab, hoping to make eye contact, but his face was clouded over. He brushed past her into the front room, and moments later the broadcast of the Punjabi news bled into the living room and drowned the silence. Corwinda propped her suitcase against the bottom stair and left it there. Sarab would bring it up for her, and then he would go back downstairs to the sitting room and fall asleep in front of the television. She drifted up the stairs to her room and unzipped her chemise. It made her shoulder ache to reach back, but she felt skittish asking for Sarab's help. What if he thought it was an invitation to touch her intimately? Or worse, what if he didn't? Corwinda shook away these thoughts. She managed to tug at the zip and drag it down eventually. Making her way to the bathroom, she passed Maya's room and paused. The door was open. Once a shrine to all things Corwinda detested about Maya's Western lifestyle, the room had been hollowed out during the move to her marital home. The piles of magazines thrown into recycling, the door hook which held a dozen handbags tossed into the garbage, the high heels, the lipstick, the ticket stubs from concerts, the novels, all chucked into boxes. Corwinda didn't remember opening the door. Sarab must have gone in there in her absence. Would he ever forgive her? There were times when she wanted to break the silence by shouting, "It was my fault, wasn't it?" She had given Maya that impossible choice. She had set up the marriage, considering it such good fortune to find a willing and available groom across the road where she could keep an eye on Maya.
"Don't embarrass me again," Kulwinda had said, when Maya came home and declared her marriage over.
In her lowest moments, Kulwinda believed that everyone was right. There was no mystery to Maya's death. She had ended her life because Kulwinda had sent her back. Kulwinda took a furtive glance at the window and saw the ghostly outlines of curtains in Dharampal's living room window. She turned away. Regret struck her, one bolt at a time. At the wedding, a clutching worry when Dharampal gave Juggy a tight embrace that lasted longer than necessary. The flash of fear that crossed Maya's face. The questioning look Sarab shot Kulwinda. The way Kulwinda, on the drive home, dismissed Sarab's concerns and said, "She's married now. She'll be happy."
If a man calls, always answer the phone with, "Oh, hey, I was just in the shower." It projects an instant image into their minds.
This was the only tip Nikki remembered from a dating advice column she'd read in one of Mindy's women's magazines. It would finally prove useful. She was in the shower, and the phone was trilling outside with the ringtone she'd programmed for Jason's calls. She was annoyed with herself for being excited. She reminded herself to be aloof. Aloof, she thought as she rang him back. Cool, casual, I wasn't waiting by the phone.
"Hi, Nikki," Jason said. "Oh, hey, man, what's happening? I had a shower," she blurted.
"Cool," Jason said.
"I mean, I was in the shower when you called."
"Oh, all right. Sorry to interrupt."
"No, it's okay. I was pretty much finished. You know what? It's not important. How are you?"
"I'm all right. Things have been a little crazy."
"Work stuff?"
Nikki offered. There was a split-second pause. "Yeah," Jason said, "and other stuff. I need to talk to you about something. Could we meet up?"
"I've got a double shift at O'Reilly's tonight," Nikki said.
"Can I meet you there?"
"Okay, it gets a bit busy after 8 on Wednesday, so sometime before."
"All right."
"Hey, Jason."
"Yeah."
"This is weird."
"What is?"
"This, you calling me out of the blue like this and then wanting to meet.
Do you not want to meet tonight?"
I do, it's just that I haven't heard from you for a while and all of a sudden you call and you say let's meet and..."
She was struggling.
"Do you know what I'm getting at?"
Jason's silence sparked her anger.
"Look, I'm a bit tired of feeling like I have to be available whenever you are," she said. "The way you left my place the other morning was very rude."
"I'm really sorry about that."
"I like you," Nikki said. "I can be honest about it. It's not that complicated for me."
"It's complicated for me. I need a chance to explain myself. There are circumstances which are quite out of my control."
"It's always circumstances, isn't it? Some foggy power that guys can't control."
"That's not fair." Nikki went quiet. Jason continued, "I like you too, Nikki, a lot. But I need to talk to you in person about where I'm at the moment. Can I see you tonight?" Nikki didn't want to give in so easily, but she also wanted to see him. She let the silence linger. "Nikki?" Jason asked. His voice was soft and uncertain.
"Yeah, all right,"
Nikki said. Last chance, she thought, though she couldn't bring herself to say it. Steve, with the racist grandfather, had a girl with him. Her long strawberry blonde hair swayed across her back as she tipped her head to laugh at whatever he was whispering into her ear. This was worthy of announcement. Nikki texted Olive.
"Steve has a girlfriend."
Olive's immediate reply.
"I'd come over to see, but I have parents' evening. Is she inflatable?" "A live one. Can't believe someone would go out with him." "I know. All the good men are taken and all the shipmen aren't even learning how shit they are."
"Any luck overseas?"
"Nope.
Lisbon boy didn't speak much English. My intellect needs as much stimulation as my other places." Nikki replied with a winking face
and returned her attention to the customers. Grace was taking orders from a group of men in suits on the end of the bar. She gave Nikki a wave.
"How's your mum, Dal?"
she asked.
"She's good. Not too cold anymore. Tell her summer's coming."
Grace was right. The chill in the air seemed duller by the day, and there were moments of lingering warmth in the afternoons. Soon summer would arrive. The cafe next door would open its outdoor courtyard, and the occasional American tourist would pop in for an authentic English pub experience and find O'Reilly's distinct lack of charm disappointing. Nikki would still be working here. This bothered her more than usual. She had a quick vision of herself growing into Grace, her raspy voice chatting up customers she'd served for decades. Steve's loud laugh broke Nikki's thoughts.
"Nikki, check out this guy on TV. Nola's saying he should drop the musical act and focus on being Osama bin Laden's body double."
A skinny, turbaned man wearing a traditional kurta sat on the vast stage and expertly slapped the heels of his palms against a tabla. The girl shifted uncomfortably.
"That's what you said," she protested.
The camera closed in on the panel of judges watching the drummer with intensity. It was Britain's Got Talent. Nikki returned to the bar to search for the remote control. Although Grace was busy with customers, they couldn't afford to have her crying over some contestant's heart-rending backstory. Where the hell was the remote control? She rushed to Sam's office and knocked on the door. No answer, but the door wasn't locked. His desk was a mess of paperwork and coffee stains. Nikki found the remote control on his chair, where he must have absent-mindedly left it. She returned to the bar and switched the channel.
"We were watching that," Steve said. "Now you're watching Top Gear," Nikki said.
Customers trickled through the door. None were Jason. Nikki took note of the time. It was past 9 now. She checked her phone for missed calls. Nothing. She sent him a text. "You still planning on coming tonight?" Her thumb hovered over the send button. It sounded whiny, desperate. She deleted the message. The kitchen door opened. Gary emerged, balancing 2 large plates on his arm.
"You're seeing Sam?"
Gary asked when he returned from serving.
"He's not in his office," Nikki said. "Tell him I'm going," Gary said. "I quit."
"What, right now?"
"No,"
Gary said.
"What happened?" "Wages here is shit," Gary said. "I asked for raise. He said maybe, maybe, then nothing. Victor also quit."
Through the glass panel on the door, Nikki could see Victor packing up his belongings.
"Gary, it's really busy."
Gary shrugged.
"Well, can't you finish up your shift and then talk to him?"
Victor came out of the kitchen.
"Talking don't work for us," he declared. "Maybe Sam gives special raise to you when you go in his office."
The comment gripped Nikki in the throat. She saw that somebody had changed the channel on the television again. A close-up shot of the tabla man showed him thanking the judges with his palms humbly pressed together in front of his chest. Steve pointed at the screen and chuckled. Outrage rippled through Nikki like a tidal wave.
"Listen, you little fuckwits," she seethed. "I have never slept with Sam, but if I did, it would be none of your damn business. You two can quit if you like. That would make my life so much easier. But if you change your minds and decide to stay, I suggest you focus on doing your damn jobs properly. Maybe then Sam might consider you competent enough to pay you the wages you feel entitled to."
A hush fell over the pub. Thin applause crackled on the television screen as the tabla player left the stage. From the corner, Steve let out a low whistle.
"You tell it like it is, Nikki," he said.
Nikki whipped around to face Steve.
"Oh, don't you pretend to be any better. I've put up with your racist rubbish for too long. I don't care that you're a customer. You can pack up your ignorant comments and get out as well."
Nikki strode to the middle of the room.
"For everybody's information, the entertainment in this establishment is decided upon by the management."
She pointed a thumb to her chest.
"Me. I decide what's playing on that screen. Whoever's got the remote, you have 10 seconds to return it to me, or at least change the channel, because we're not watching Britain's Got Bloody Talent!"
Grace stepped forward and produced the remote control with a guilty duck of her head. Somebody in the back of the room started an ill-advised slow clap, which quickly died. Nikki changed the channel and went back behind the bar, where Gary and Victor shared a nervous glance and retreated to the kitchen.
"Why don't you take the rest of the shift off, love? I've got this," Grace said.
"I'm fine. It was just... they say such insulting things, and I've started getting angry at myself for not saying anything, and..."
Grace's face was wide with understanding.
"You said what you had to say, darling. No need to explain."
"I didn't mean to be so harsh about the remote control," Nikki said.
"That's quite all right," Grace said. "I don't know what that show does to me, but the tears start coming and I just can't stop crying. You've seen it."
"I have," Nikki said.
"My husband says, it's women, it's in your chemical makeup. You can't control being overwhelmed by emotion."
"But I don't get that way about sad movies or even those news items. Little girl diagnosed with rare cancer on the news the other day. I frowned and said, what a shame, and moved on. But that man working two jobs to be able to pay for his sister's contortionist classes so she can one day perform in the Royal Variety Show."
Grace choked on her words. At this point, anything was better for this pub than Britain's Got Talent. Nikki gave Grace a sympathetic squeeze of her shoulder and flipped to the next channel. They landed on a grim scene. Police combing through dense foliage and then a sergeant talking to the camera. Perfect, she thought. Customers politely avoided Nikki, leaving her idle at the bar. She checked the time on her phone once again and surveyed the pub. No Jason. That was it. She searched for his contact details, took in a breath, and deleted his number. She didn't want to be tempted to call him. In the corner, Steve leaned over to whisper something to Nola, and Nola sprang from her seat and left the pub in a huff. Steve's grin disappeared. He scrambled after Nola. Grace raced over to the entrance, blocking his way.
"You got a tab to pay," she reminded him.
Then she said something that Nikki couldn't hear. Sulking, Steve pulled out his wallet and threw some bills at Grace and left. Grace picked up the money and brought it over to Nikki.
"He's an accidental tipper," she said. "Here's your share."
"Oh, no, Grace, no. You've been serving him tonight."
"You've been putting up with him for years," Grace said. "You deserve a reward. I told him Sam would have him removed if he tried to come back. He's no longer welcome here because he makes our staff and patrons uncomfortable."
She pressed the bills into Nikki's hand. Grace's gesture stirred something in Nikki. She couldn't believe how much she missed Mum all of a sudden. Mum, who had pushed money into her hand the same insistent way the first time she returned home for dinner after moving out. Nikki's phone was still in her hand. She searched for Mum's number and began composing a message, but the words didn't come to her. She called her instead. After several rings, Nikki was tempted to hang up, but then Mum picked up.
"Nikki?"
"Hi, Mum. How are you?"
"I was just thinking about you."
Those simple words warmed Nikki's heart.
"I was thinking about you too, Mum.
I need you to do me a favour."
There was an edge of slight panic in Mum's voice.
"Auntie Geeta is coming over tomorrow, and I have no Indian snacks to serve. The shop I usually go to in Enfield is closed temporarily. Death in the family, I heard, and the other shops don't have enough variety. Can you go to Southall and buy some gulab jamun, laddu, barfi, jalebi, whatever they have, and bring them here? Oh, I also need some cardamom for tea. The cardamom at Waitrose is too expensive."
Here Nikki was thinking they were about to have a bonding moment. Her schedule for tomorrow was wide open.
"Sure, Mum," Nikki said.
She knew better than to ask Mum why she still bothered socialising with Auntie Geeta, for whom an unsatisfactory afternoon tea was probably symbolic of a woman's failings.
"Why is it so noisy?"
I'm at a movie."
"The new job is going well?"
"Uh-huh."
"You're liking teaching. Maybe this is a new career path for you."
I don't know, Mum," Nikki said, eager to cut the conversation short. "I have to go. I'll see you tomorrow afternoon."
Mum said goodbye, and Nikki slipped her phone back in her pocket.
She didn't know if she was disappointed, relieved, or amused at how the call turned out. If only Jason were around, they'd laugh over it together. A customer approached Nikki tentatively and asked if happy hour was still on. Sure, Nikki said, although it had ended 15 minutes ago, and she poured him a lager. Despite her best efforts to stop thinking about Jason, she couldn't help looking at the door again and wishing that he'd just show up and apologize for being late. Nikki's phone buzzed in her pocket. She checked it to find a message from Mum. Another thing, please be careful in Saldol. They are showing what happened to Karina Kaur on Channel 4 now. Don't walk around there at night. Nikki looked up at the television screen. The Channel 4 logo glowed in the bottom corner. The narrator's voice was barely audible in the buzz of pub conversation, so Nikki switched on the closed captioning. On 8th of April 2003, a girl was reported missing after she did not return home from school. Karina Kaur, a Year 12 student at Southall Secondary College, was only weeks away from sitting her final exams. After a 48-hour period, a search began for the missing student. Two young women waved at Nikki from their table.
Is it still happy hour?
One of them asked. Nikki shook her head. The woman glanced at the customer nursing his lager.
You sure?
She asked. Nikki took their orders, keeping an eye on the screen. The next set of captions accompanied footage of small, flickering flames. Then the camera zoomed out to show a crowd of high school students in uniform holding candles. After the discovery of Karina's body, a vigil was set up outside her school.
I thought I told you to take the evening off. Go on, get some rest, Grace said, setting down a tray.
Nikki nodded vaguely at Grace, but she couldn't tear her attention away from the screen. Filling the television screen, a young Punjabi woman stood at the tall iron gates of a school. She gripped a lit candle with two manicured hands, the nails hot pink with glittery gold tips. The flame illuminated the streaks of tears down her face and the gold pendant which rested on her collarbone in the shape of the letter G. The man behind the counter at Sweetie Sweets probably thought he was paying Nikki a compliment.
These gulab jamun are worth the calories, he had said, looking her up and down. Not that you need to worry, eh? Not yet anyway, he chuckled. Before marriage, my wife was also skinny.
If you could just pack these in a box for me, that'd be great, Nikki said quickly, cutting him off.
No problem, dear. You're having a little party? Am I invited?
He grinned, leaning closer. Nikki was very close to smashing a gulab jamun in the guy's forehead when his wife emerged from a back room. Suddenly, he became very busy finding a box for the sweets. The wife glared at Nikki as she paid and left. She checked the time on her phone. It was too early to go to Mum's without having to sit through countless questions that she wouldn't be able to answer about her teaching job. She strolled along the Broadway, where the pavement was crowded with discount clothing racks and vegetable crates. A crooked line of men had formed outside a mobile phone shop selling overseas calling cards. Stacked atop these stores were more businesses, overlapping signs popping out from the buildings like cartoon speech bubbles. Pankaj Madhur, Accounting, Himalaya Guest House, RHP Surveillance, PTE Limited. What Nikki used to consider chaos now felt very much like home as she wove through the throng of people, the box of sweets tucked under her arm. Eventually she came to an intersection and crossed it to find herself standing at the entrance of the Bank of Baroda. Sheena was sitting at a counter and assisting a customer when Nikki walked in.
Next, called the woman in the window next to hers. No, thank you, Nikki said. I'm here to see Sheena.
Sheena looked up. She returned to the customer and then walked out to greet Nikki with an air of professionalism that belied the confusion on her face.
Kelly, I'm going on my lunch break, she called.
Once they were outside, Sheena's smile vanished.
What are you doing here? She asked. Can we talk? Oh, Nikki, I knew I should have asked you before passing those stories around. You're upset, aren't you? Listen, the women coming to the next class are trustworthy. We'll talk tonight about what to say to the brothers if they question us.
It's not about the stories, Nikki said. It's Karina Kaur I'm curious about. The concern on Sheena's face faded.
You're interrupting my lunch hour, she replied.
I can't talk to you about it at the temple because there are too many eavesdroppers. I had to come here.
What makes you think I know anything?
Nikki described.